It's another blind like me with Phil Parr. That would be me. And it's not the Ken folks. It's just me coming into your homes. And our guest is a fellow that you might have heard his voice, especially if you're a resident of the state of Mississippi. Mike Duke, welcome to Blind Like Me, sir.
Well, thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
I don't know where. I think I first ran across you on back when Snowbarger was doing ACB radio, and you were, seems like you came in sometimes on that Monday night thing that he had going. Am I thinking correctly? Or?
Well, actually, I never did do that. I listened to it a lot, but I never did do that. I sent emails to him every now and then, and he would mention my name. So that's probably where you heard my name.
Obviously, you have you're not just the average guy off the street as far as radio is concerned. Did you get a chance to do some commercial broadcasting at one time?
I am your basic radio junkie. When I was 4 years old, thereabout. My memories aren't real clear before age four, so I always tell people this happened at age four. I remember saying to my mom one day in that, "Hey, stop world, here's the way it is," manner of a four-year-old. And I said, "When I grow up, I'm going to work for the radio station." And mother, partly out of not knowing anything else to say, most likely, and partly to appease me a little bit, said, "Oh, that's nice." Well, the short story is I grew up and did it.
Yeah.
I spent 12 years in commercial radio after graduation from college, and then in 1988 came to the job that I have now, which is Director of Radio Reading Service of Mississippi, which is a statewide network that's part of Mississippi Public Broadcasting.
Well, 12 years in commercial radio is certainly enough for anyone.
I would hate to know I had to go back. I would do it and could do it pretty well still. It's obviously in the time that I've been away from it, it has changed a whole lot. When I left last commercial radio job I had, the station did not own a CD player.
Really?
And I was music director at that time, so anything that came in on CD, I got to keep.
Because they didn't have a CD player.
They did not have a CD player. They had two Tusco turntables.
Yeah.
We were talking gadgets before we started recording.
I've got one. Well, I've got one. I have one. In fact, I have one that plays 78s.
Yeah, ours, we had the three-speed models. We didn't use 78s, of course, by then, but... But they were still on the lever on the front.
Well, I've got some, and so I was glad when the guy liberated these, and one of the stations and up north of us went to CDs, and they wanted to throw out these old turntables. And boy, I was thrilled when he brought them to me. I think I probably bought his lunch that day or something. So, and they were still using carts back then.
Yes. In fact, I got here and I screamed for a cart machine, and they said, "No, we don't do that anymore."
No, we don't. If you want one, I've got one I'll give you. I've got a three-stack and a stereo cart recorder and a stereo three-stack and a big sack of carts under the shelf in my storeroom.
Yeah, well, of course, now with computers and things like SoundForge and various other recorders, nobody uses them anymore.
Don't need that anymore, do we?
No.
I forgot to start my stopwatch. I'm going to guess that we've killed 5 minutes. What would be your?
I would say somewhere between 3 and 5, yeah.
I'm going to guess at 5 minutes. I just forgot we got to talking. And let's get back early when you were a little child. Your parents raised you. Where were you raised? In Mississippi there?
I'm a native of Mississippi. I was born in Newton, Mississippi, which was named for Isaac Newton. I don't know why it was named for Isaac. He never set foot in the place. But... My Mom still lives in the house that I grew up in.
Really?
I was born in 1954 in Newton, Mississippi, and was diagnosed 6 months later with as being totally blind from birth. It seems that there was a basically a cold solder joint. The optic nerve and the brain don't communicate. Everything is there, but the two just don't communicate. And I have a little bit of light perception, and that's all.
And nobody knows why they don't.
Nobody knows why. It was nothing anyone did, and just as importantly, nothing anyone didn't do.
And you went back and traced your genealogy probably a little bit, and there's no other blindness in the...
Well, there's no other total blindness that I've been able to find. I do have some cousins that have one artificial eye or whatever, but the other eye works fine.
I have almost as, I don't know whether they say I had no optic nerve or it wasn't connected. I guess it just wasn't, as I had the same thing. There's no other blindness anywhere. There's no, my sister, fine, my brother and I just both both born totally blind.
Yeah.
And
I have an older brother and an older sister with normal vision.
Is that right?
That diagnosis, the blindness diagnosis, not so much what was wrong, but the diagnosis was made by my family doctor, the general practitioner that actually delivered me. That started, and the best news is I don't remember any of this. I just remember, obviously having heard about it.
Being told about it,
But that started a parade of eye doctors all over the Southeast and ultimately wound up with a trip to the Mayo Clinic. The fall of 1955, when I was 9 months old. The people at the Mayo Clinic, someone there at that time was obviously a good thinker and probably a little ahead of their time, when they told my folks that, he is blind, here's what we think is causing it, nothing can be done to correct it. Nothing you did caused it. Nothing you could have done would prevent it. Stop the parade of doctors and go home and teach him how to live.
Yeah.
And my folks were able to take that advice. And from that point forward, I didn't have anything other than the routine eye exams.
Yeah.
And was well aware by the time that I was, by the time that I was four, I was well aware that I could not see and that I would not go to school with my brother and sister. I knew I would go to school, but not go to school with them. Because in the late 50s and through the 60s, that really not going to school for the blind was not an option in Mississippi.
Yeah, as it was becoming an option in other parts of the country, but I guess probably not where you were.
Right.
But that was such good advice from this guy at the Mayo Clinic.
It really was. It was probably the greatest thing that ever happened to me, and to them, because it, although I'm sure it was tough on them at times, they went home and did their best to follow that advice after that.
Well, it was tough on your mother to send you. Just as it was on mine to send me, because this was back in 46, and 80 miles was a long way. She sent me from San Antonio to Austin.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was 65 miles away.
Yeah, and it was a long distance.
At that time in Mississippi, the state law allowed you to start school when you were five if you turned six by the end of the calendar year.
Okay.
I got in by 3 days because my birthday is in late December.
Yeah.
And, so I started school at five and a half.
And that was...
it had to be tough. I mean, it was...
Sure it was.
Looking back on it, it was tough enough on me as a five-year-old. At the time, I didn't realize all of the ramifications of that. But
you didn't realize your mother as an adult would endure... Would be tough. You didn't realize adults had any problems.
No. They were just adults, and they were supposed to deal with tough stuff.
Yeah, they knew how to do it. I know. And I've often looked back on my poor old mother sending sending me 80 miles away. So, but you were you a weekend student or a day?
I was a dormitory student and came home. After I was there for 3 weeks, I started coming home every weekend. In one of the preschool workshops, they encouraged all of the parents of the new children to leave them there 2 or 3 weeks at least. And so at the end of the second week, I still remember very well that my parents, my brother, my sister, and my sister's boyfriend, who is now her husband, all came to the school to see me on a Sunday, and we went out and had a picnic, went to the zoo, and did, you know, fun stuff like that.
Yeah.
And for the day. And then the following Friday, I did not even know that this was going to happen, but the house mother at the school earlier that week wrote my family a note and said he's ready to come home for a visit, because now when he goes home for a visit, he'll be okay coming back. And so from that point until I was old enough to decide that there was something going on the weekends that I wanted to stay for, I went home every weekend.
Went home every weekend. Did they put you on the bus then, or did your parents come get you, or how? What?
Most of the time, they came and got me. I would ride the bus home, usually for Thanksgiving and spring break, just because of the fact we got out of school earlier on a Wednesday.
And Daddy was working or something.
And my dad was working, and later my mom was working, and so it was easier for them. And it was started out initially as an adventure for me. To ride the bus, but I rode the bus home for Thanksgiving when I was 6 years old, or 5 years old, rather.
And back then, whether it was or not, we thought it was all right to put a seven-year-old kid on the bus. You wouldn't consider doing that.
Perfectly fine.
It was.
You know, now you'd shudder to think of them riding across town on a city bus.
You wouldn't.
Alone across the state.
You wouldn't do it.
No.
No responsible parent would do it, especially not a totally blind child. That's
right, because I remember I got to sit on the very front seat of the bus right behind the driver, they knew every time I wiggled my toe,
totally different world we live in. I don't know what's changed, but something has.
Yeah.
But so you made it through Mississippi. I guess you graduated from this
Mississippi School for the Blind.
And from the tone of your voice, I gather that it was not too bad an experience for you.
It wasn't. It had its bumps. And if I were to, as an adult, dwell too long on one of those bumps, I could turn it into something that would be really, that could be catastrophic. But it was by no means perfect.
Yeah.
Neither is anyone else's education experience. But overall, it was quite good. And I got, at that time, from the School for the Blind, education-wise, I received as good of an education background as my brother and sister did going to the public school in our hometown.
Yeah.
Because there were times when we were using, of course they were older than me, but there were times when I used the same textbooks that they had used. And I'd come home on the weekends and they'd help me with homework and things like that.
And you started, of course, back then, we had Braille. That's all we had. And
there was reel-to-reel tape part of that time, and then the first recorded textbook I ever saw was on Evitone sound sheets.
Yeah, remember those?
And I thought, boy, these things sound awful. I'd just as soon do Braille.
Yeah, they sounded awful, but for us non-Braille readers, they were convenient, you know.
Oh, yes. I'm sure they worked well, you know, for that. Of course, by the time I got to college, Recording for the Blind was using Open Reel, and I was part of the test group to test what became the standard four-track
cassette. Really?
That RFB&D, RFB it was at the time, developed. I was one of the the test cases for.
You were a beta tester.
And we didn't know what that was then.
Would you
like to test our cassette books? I said yes.
Oh, I wouldn't. I sure would. You know, I got some magazine, maybe U.S. News and World Reports, on Evitone sound sheets up until early 2000s.
Yes, I used to get QST, the ham radio magazine, on sound sheet, and it was one of the last ones to switch to cassette.
Yeah, and I bought a four-track machine, and I dub it from the old talking book machine to cassette so I could be portable.
Mm-hmm.
So I could carry it around.
Done that many a day. In fact, I've even dubbed them to two-track.
Yeah, so you'd be a little more, because it's an old clunky record player, you couldn't haul anywhere. Let's take a break, and let's talk about your high school, what you did in high school, and I'm sure your interest in radio began to manifest itself, as you said, at 4 years old. So we'll talk about that in a minute. Our guest is Mike Duke, back in a minute with more of Blind Like Me.
Serve.
The thing I like the best about the Blind Handyman List, great place to exchange information and gather ideas on anything to do with being a handyman around the house.
I found out how to fix my garbage disposal on the Handyman List, and it worked.
If you'd like to join the Blind Handyman List, send a blank email to blindhandyman-subscribe@yahoogroups.com. That's blindhandyman-subscribe@yahoogroups.com.
The thing I like about the Blind Handyman List, I'm the moderator, and I can delete you if I want to. So don't get out of line. Stay on topic.
That's blindhandyman-subscribe@yahoogroups.com. A trip to Walmart.
I wonder where the pharmacy is. It's somewhere over here. Oh, God, I've got my cane caught in something.
Pardon me, sir. I don't know how to tell you this, but the end of your cane is stuck in my...
Why bother shopping the big discount stores when you can shop from the comfort of your own home at blindmysmart.com?
Hi, this is Dale Campbell, president of Blind My Smart. If you can't find what you're looking for today, check back tomorrow. We're adding new products every day.
Blind My Smart, with thousands of products at a completely accessible website. Our address is blindmysmart.com. Again, that's www.blindmysmart.com. Blind Science. Here's a website our crack research team certifies screen reader friendly. Now, with this week's Blind Science, here's Tim Cummings.
Are you one of those people that's really interested in shortwave listening and you'd like to find a good place to purchase shortwave receivers? You may be thinking, well, they're not as popular now because a lot of the radio stations have gone over to the internet. But if you're one of those people that still would like to buy a nice shortwave receiver, you should take a look at universalradio.com. The website is www.universal-radio.com. It's a very reputable shortwave radio dealer. They sell shortwave receivers. They sell police scanners, also ham receivers and transceivers. Again, the website is www.universal-radio.com. I give it a screen reader friendliness rating of a 9. And for blind sights, this is Tim Cummings saying, keep on blind sighting.
If you found a screen reader friendly website you'd like us to mention, send your email to blindlikeme, all one word, at txucom.net. And join us again next time for Blind Sights.
Mike, all right. That's fine. Mike Duke is our guest from what town in Mississippi are you in? I forgot to ask.
Jackson.
Is that the capital?
That's the state capital, and it's where the school for the blind is.
And so
I've done a lot of growing up here and then wound up working here.
Working in Jackson. And Mike is a is the head of the radio reading service in Mississippi, which, and we'll get to that in a few minutes, which is, as far as I'm concerned, a little more progressive than maybe some of the other radio reading services we have throughout the state. Let's talk about high school. Did you all get together and form a little radio club? Because there were other blind kids interested in radio also.
We did get together and have sort of a club. There were three of us in school, all three of us were totally blind, who were just hell-bent on working in radio, didn't want to talk about, think about, or dream about doing anything else.
I know.
And the strange thing in this case is that all three of us grew up and did it. We each did it slightly differently, but it's worked for all three of us.
Really?
And one of them is now an owner of an AM station here in town that started out as a small 500-watt station and is now a 10,000-watt station that programs bluegrass music and has quite a following. The other one had some family money that he could get a hold of, and he built several stations from the ground up, including one just recently, and got into buying and selling stations. He would buy a station that was floundering and keep it long enough for it to make a profit for a month or two, and then unload it and make a killing. So, and then there was me, who worked for other people. I decided early on in the business that I did not necessarily want to own a station, but I worked for three different commercial stations and then came here. So all three of us basically fulfilled our dream and would go back and do it again.
See, that's the only goal in my life I never was able to accomplish. I never was able to own a station, because by the time I got to where I had sense enough to own one, you couldn't do it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're auctioning things off now.
Yes.
I just thought if you could do production real good and you were a good disc jockey and you kept your nose clean, somebody'd hire you. Wrong. Tube type breath.
It seems that the more dirty your nose, the more job opportunities you have sometimes.
Yeah, at station, you went to the old station, they gave you a drug test, and if you didn't have any drugs in your system, they fire you.
Yeah, there's something wrong. You're in the wrong business, right?
You're in the wrong business. And so you and these other three guys would get together and talk radio and live radio.
Constantly. When I was in the first grade, the radio and TV repairman in our town, in Newton, where I grew up, used to make house calls.
Yeah.
And so he would give me, when we'd call him to fix the television, he would give me whatever came out of the television to play with. But when I was in the first grade and started school, he gave me what at that time was a pretty expensive gift. It was a Channel Master 6-transistor radio. I'd give anything to have it again.
Yeah.
But it's long gone, Lord knows where. And I got to school, and I was one of maybe three kids in the school that had a transistor radio. And my first grade best friend, who moved away, so he was not one of the three that I mentioned earlier, he and I would have contests every morning after breakfast. There was a wonderful radio station in New Orleans called WNOE.
At 1060.
1060, right.
Yeah.
And our contest was to see whose transistor radio would play the loudest on WNOE after breakfast. Now, we weren't smart enough at the time to realize that whoever had bought the newest battery won the contest, but it was great fun.
So you tune around on the dial and see whose radios would get stations better.
Yes. And then when we got a station, who could play the loudest and the clearest on that station?
Yeah. Well, that same scenario was playing out in Austin, Texas, sir.
Cheap entertainment.
That same scenario. We would go out and have contests, and to see if you could name a station on every frequency.
Mm-hmm.
You had to know a station on every frequency, or you were, you know.
And
I remember
logs of we didn't in the first grade, of course, but late by the time we got into junior high, there were one of the other radio junkies and I would keep logs of on 540 I got this station, and on 1600 I got this one.
So you tune around at night and see what you could get, or.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, same thing going on, and I guess at blind schools all over these great United States.
I didn't know at the time, didn't understand why there were certain places on the wall where if you held your radio near that, you could pick up more stuff.
Well, there were certain rooms in the cottage that were better for radios, and I always got there. I made my parents take me back early so I could get one of those good rooms, man.
Me and that old... get the bed by the window and stuff, and later FM came along, and of course we did the same thing with FM.
That's
I can remember when there was one FM station in Jackson, Mississippi, and I think it was one of three in the state.
And it probably played classical music.
It played elevator music, not even classical, just elevator music.
Yeah.
And you, just on the antenna on the back of your FM radio in the morning, you could pick up stations. There was a station in Texarkana, Texas, that would come into Jackson, Mississippi almost every morning on that little... 19-20-inch piece of wire on the back of the radio for an antenna.
Yeah, a little skip, a little temperature inversion.
Yeah, propagation stuff. But
I remember the first, I moved to this area in 72, and in about 1974, a guy came through that knew me, a radio guy, and he said, man, you're not going to believe what happened in Houston, Texas, the book this time. What happened? One of the FM stations was number one. And I went, that's not possible. That's certainly not. FM, schmefm.
That didn't happen here until the early 80s. And my second radio job was for an independent, locally owned FM station that had no AM attached.
Whoa.
And there were two, in the town of Vicksburg at the time, there were two FM stations, neither of which was attached to either of the two AM stations that were in town.
And I remember saying one time, Jesus, I'm sure glad I've got this AM to help support my FM. But that quickly changed. So, are you a musician? Did you play music in school?
I played in school. I played the instrument that strikes terror into the hearts of mothers everywhere.
Yes,
the drums.
Really?
And I always was fascinated by drums, and I had the world's largest cardboard box drum set as a child. And would sit there and bang out, Elvis Presley records. You know, if you're in Mississippi, it's assumed you like Elvis, and if you don't, you don't tell anybody.
Oh,
but
yeah.
My sister had all the Elvis records, and so I'd sit there and I'd hammer out with whatever I could find that I could hit with the rhythms on the Elvis records, and finally convinced the band director at the school to let me touch the drum set. And the rest is. Sort of history, as they say. I wound up being the drummer for the stage band at school for 6 years, and loved it. Didn't really want to pursue it as a profession. Probably wasn't nearly good enough to do that either. But really enjoyed the drums, and sat through the torture of elementary and junior high piano lessons, where you the teacher says, play these notes with the right hand and these notes with the left hand, and you memorize the routines, and you get up and have the recital, and you hope you remember it, and Aunt Susie says, oh, you're wonderful.
You're great.
Why won't you play at church? Because I can't play a note.
I wish I'd paid more attention to those.
Yes.
I didn't know.
I know. And in the midst of all of that, I discovered ham radio.
Oh, really?
Which I discovered it when I was about 10. Checked out a Braille book from the library at school called How to Become a Radio Amateur. My brother had built, in 1965, had built a Heathkit. We were talking earlier about Heathkit.
Yeah.
Had built a Heathkit CB radio, which they actually made at the time. And that had sort of fascinated me with shortwave. And then I discovered ham radio, and about that same time, again, the radio repairman, radio and television repair guy at Newton found and gave me, or my parents bought for me, and he put it together, from Allied Radio, a broadcast oscillator. You could hook up a microphone and a phonograph, and you weren't supposed to hook but 10 feet of antenna wire up to it. And you could hear it in the other end of your house or over at the neighbors. And, of course, there's this little thing in your brain that says, now, if 10 feet of wire will carry this signal 100 feet, what would 150 feet of wire do to it?
So you're immediately strung up a long wire.
So you put up the longest piece of wire you can, and you wind up with a signal that gets almost all the way into town.
And this was on the AM band?
This was on AM.
Well, I never saw one of those.
And it had three tubes that sat on the top of it, and there was no cover. So if you reached up and grabbed the wrong thing, you came away with warm fingers. I kept that thing around the house. I wish I'd still kept it. I saw one on eBay a while back, and it would horrify you to know what people were bidding for it.
But you could. But it had a mic input and a line input also. So
it had a mic input and an input for. It had to be a ceramic cartridge. It didn't have a preamp in it. But
no preamp. Yeah.
But it did have a phono input and a microphone input. Used RCA type plugs on it, and then a little terminal on the back that you just clipped an antenna wire to, and we'd hook it up to the window screens, or we'd hook it up to, as I said, on a good day, as long a piece of wire as we could string out the window.
But it didn't mind. It didn't mind being grounded if you grounded it.
No.
And so you would do the Mike Duke show.
I would.
That's
I would. And then I got brave enough with that I carried it to school, to the dormitory. Ran a loop of wire around the room and fired that thing up and made up the call letters WMSB, which later became the call letters of the campus radio station at Mississippi State University.
Is that right?
And again, the other radio guys and I, and we had a local guy, a student there at the time that was and still is fascinated with sports. He didn't care that much about radio, but he was a great sports reporter. And so we'd have the radio station, and our radio station would come on the air after study hall and stay on as long as we could get away with it.
WMSB.
Yes.
I love it. I love it.
And so we ran that thing for, most of a year. And by then I had taken the novice license. And,
got your code speed up.
For the ham bands, and got the code speed up, took the general license at age 15, later went on to get the advanced and extra.
Did you have a ham rig at the blind school?
I did not, just had a receiver. I had a Zenith receiver. There was still a lot of AM on the ham bands, and so the Zenith receiver worked pretty well for listening to that. Wasn't a transoceanic. It was at the late 60s slide rule dial version that the Zenith had that had some string of meaningless numbers in it and letters for the model number. But nevertheless, I listened to many, many people on that receiver that I later talked to and that later became friends.
Yeah, because I was going to say, if you had a ham rig there, you probably got into everybody's television. Everybody did back then.
Well, some schools did have radio clubs, and actually the year after I graduated, they did put a station there. They had, by then, I think three or four other students that got their licenses just about the time I was graduating, and they put up a station, and then the teacher who was overseeing the station left the following year, and the equipment was taken down and eventually lost. We don't know exactly what happened to it. They had a bunch of Heathkit equipment that just sort of disappeared over the years, as people would say, "What's that? I don't know. We don't need it. Let's pitch it."
You throw it away, State bought it to hell with it. Who needs it?
Exactly.
But that ham radio did not satiate your appetite for being a commercial radio person at all.
No,
it's not the same. It's not the same thing. It's totally different.
It's totally different. It reinforced it and helped it in that learning all the things I had to learn to get the ham license gave me a bit of understanding about how radio worked. And I tell people I know just enough about that to be dangerous at a transmitter, but it helped me have a better understanding for what was going on or should be going on in terms of the transmitter and when it was sounding right and when it wasn't. It helped me psychologically by giving me a lot of confidence in the fact that, yes, this was a field I could learn. And sometimes I feel like, and this may be more psychological than anything else, but I feel like there were times when the fact that by the time I started looking for radio jobs, I had the advanced class ham license, which is really the toughest of the tests. It gave me a bit of an edge with people who knew what that was and knew you didn't just walk in and off the street and get handed that license.
Yeah.
So, you know, it helped people realize that I was serious about the radio business.
Well, and then, too, when you finally got into commercial radio, you realized that a lot of your sighted brethren didn't know nearly as much as you did.
Exactly.
About how radio worked and the actual electronics and whether the transmitter sounded good or not.
That's right. That's right. And so what happened a lot of times was we learned from each other. They taught me how radio works in practice as opposed to on paper.
Yeah.
I taught some of them, you know, enough basic electronics to know how to swap out the cart machine when it died in the middle of the night or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, or to clean the heads, at least.
Yes.
At least to know enough to do that. Okay, so you got through high school, and you were going to do radio, so you went somewhere and got a degree in communications, I bet you.
I did. I went to Mississippi State University, which is where my brother had attended college, and there were I had three possible choices. There was a debate as to whether or not I should go to junior college first, community college, as they call it now. I ultimately chose not to do that, and the reason was it saved me learning two campuses.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, there were two schools in Mississippi that had broadcast schools or communications departments.
Mm-hmm.
The one at Mississippi State was actually still being developed when I entered as a freshman, and they seemed more eager to talk to me and to basically to take me serious and acted like they wanted me as a student, so that's where I went.
Well, you were the first blind student probably to do that.
I was the first blind student in that department. I wasn't the first blind student at Mississippi State.
But you were the first blind student in the communications.
Yes, because at that time it was still I think maybe less than 2 years old department.
And you had to take some other things along with that, along with communications. Television, we had TV by then, so you had to do some TV. You had to learn about cameras. And
I did take the introduction course, and then but that's really as far as I went in the television side.
But radio is what you wanted
radio
to do.
Radio is what I really wanted.
And
of course, I had to take some of the journalism, too, which was actually quite helpful.
Sure.
In radio, and I wish, really, that I'd taken more of that. I also wish we'd had a spell checker back then.
Or paid more attention when you took them.
Yes.
Did they have a little campus radio operation there?
They built one while I was a student. It came on the air when I was a sophomore.
Really?
And I was able then to do some work with it, not as much as I would like to have done. It was all student-operated, basically volunteer, and was used for the lab for the broadcast courses, and that's where I did, you know, how I did most of my work there, was coursework in the production lab and so forth. But wish I had been able to do a little more of it, but of course there were tons and tons and tons of people that wanted to get on there and play radio.
Now, what did you want to do on the radio? Did you want to be a disc jockey, or what did you want to do with radio?
Well, I of course started out wanting to be a disc jockey or a DJ. At age four, you know, my idea was, hey, this person goes to work and plays records, and that's something that's fun to do.
That's something
I want to do.
And talks, gets to talk.
Yeah, well, I wasn't really that interested in talking. I just wanted to play the records.
But by college, had you come to some realization that disc jockeys don't make any money, or did that ever dawn on you?
At the time, it didn't. It really did not dawn on me until after college and I went to work.
until you actually got a job as a disc jockey.
My first job was like $2.65 an hour, and it was part-time.
What year was this?
That was in 1976. It took me through college to get that job at my hometown station, where, you know, a lot of kids got it in high school, work weekends or whatever. They, you know, sort of almost wished I would go away, and I never would do it. And I finally got a part-time job there the summer I graduated from college.
This was an AM operation?
This was an AM with a 3,000-watt FM that was not even stereo.
That nobody cared about.
Right.
And
the AM was a 500-watt daytimer.
And, okay.
It was country music. And I stayed with that job and worked it into pretty much full time. I stayed there for a little over a year. And then I took a full-time job in Vicksburg at the tremendous rate of $120 a week.
That how much? $120
a week.
Well, yeah.
You know, $3 an hour for a 40-hour week, which 40-hour weeks in radio are mythological.
They don't, nobody, never,
they don't
never.
Exist.
You get there, as soon as you can get up in the morning, you get to the station, then you stay till you get ready to go to bed.
That's right. That's right. And that was in September of 1977. I stayed in Vicksburg for 5.5 years and had some of the greatest and most challenging radio experiences of my career.
Well, then you were program director in Vicksburg.
No, I was pretty much just an announcer and music director. Then some ownership changes and station management decisions came along, and I did not get fired, but it was time to go because it was costing me money to go to work. That station is no longer in business, and then I moved back in with my parents and went to work at a station about 15 miles away that had at that time a 28,000, I think it was, watt FM.
Uh-huh.
With a 10 kW daytime AM directional tied to it. While I worked there, we put up a 1,000-foot tower, 100,000-watt transmitter, and I was the first person to sign on that transmitter.
Really?
And that was sort of a thrill to know that I was actually touching the new stuff.
That you were the new guy.
I was the first person to do that.
With the new stereo 80 console from Harris.
Yeah.
Probably. Probably with those big, great, if you had a console with the big knobs.
Big knobs you could wrap your fist around.
Yeah, that's a stereo 80 or a stereo. They made two models of that. I actually owned one of those, and it was. I just sat and played with it for about an hour after it was set in my house. It was just thrilling for me. Anyway, let's just walk back to Vicksburg 1 second. You say you were music director there. Did you actually get to choose the music the station played?
I did.
That's unusual.
It was very unusual.
It is.
And I did the same thing later in Forest after I moved over to that station. All the records would come in, and I'd come in, and there'd be this pile of records on my desk every week. And I did that, or every day, because records would come daily.
Oh, yeah.
And I did it a little bit differently. I developed a thing where I did it a little bit differently. When I started out, I'd have somebody name me the records, and I'd write them all down. And I got to where I would go through, and I would listen to them first, and I would pull, the ones, obviously, if certain names came in, I'd recognize by
the
sound of the voice. And you knew you were going to play those, so you really didn't bother listening to them all that much. But by not knowing ahead of time that this song was by, Mr. Wannabe or Miss Wannabe, you would sometimes give it a better listen than you would if you knew up front that it was some unknown person that might not ever be heard.
Now, did you look at Cashbox and Billboard magazine? Did someone read their top 100 to you?
Someone read those to me, and I actually had to fill out Cashbox magazine reports for a while for one of the stations.
Okay.
And they would call me on the phone each week. Cashbox would call me on the phone and give me, I'd give them the list of what we were playing and how we ranked them. So we were a reporting station.
Uh-huh.
There's a funny story about that. There was one particular singer had some records, and I wish I had kept them. They were on independent labels. And they were, so-so. They weren't anything to jump up and down over. And near the end of my stay at Forest, one of the promoters, they'd hire these record promoters, and they would call up and say, "Hey, will you play the new Alabama song?" And this was actually they, by then they weren't promoting Alabama, but I got calls in Vicksburg about Alabama, you know. So they would say, hey, will you play this song by this artist? And sometimes I'd say yes, and sometimes I'd say no. Well, there was one particular artist I kept saying no to. And finally, one day, the promoter called, and he said, why won't you play his records? They're good. And I said, well, I know. He said, why won't you play these records? And I said, when he comes out with a good record, we'll play it. Well,
yeah.
About 6 weeks after I made that comment, I changed jobs and came here to Radio Reading Service. 2 months later, Garth Brooks had his first number one record. He owes me big time for getting out of the business.
That's pretty good. We when I was managing the radio station here in Lufkin, we didn't take Billboard or Cashbox. We just looked through the stack of records, and if we liked it, we played it, and if we didn't, we didn't.
That's the way the first station I worked for was, and initially that's the way Vicksburg was when I first went there.
So we ended up playing a lot of stuff that nobody else ever heard of and nobody else played.
Oh, absolutely, and especially Answer Records. Remember Answer Records?
Oh, sure.
We played a lot of that stuff that nobody would touch.
Yeah, we'd get three or four of the other DJs together in a case of beer, and we'd play, listen to every 2 weeks and sit down and listen to the stack of records that came in. And if it was good, we'd put it on the playlist, and if it wasn't, we didn't.
And I was, I came into country radio. All three of these jobs were country stations,
yeah.
Although I was a rock and roll fan from birth. I came into country radio just as the outlaw movement took off and really got big.
Okay.
And had running battles with management who said, well, it doesn't sound like George Jones, you know. Thank goodness. not that I don't like George Jones, because I do. But we would play, sometimes we would push the envelope and play, you know, what then was called the outlaw stuff and later progressive country. And
records by major people like Olivia Newton-John. You can't play that on a country station.
Right.
Well,
and, you know, and... Jerry Jeff Walker, mm-hmm. and a lot of the Austin stuff that we would slip in,
mm-hmm.
and you know, we learned as we did it that there were certain times of the day it worked better than others.
And you were playing 45s. You weren't carton music. You were playing 45s.
Playing 45s and sometimes an album cut. I used to play album tracks on every, you know, every hour. We'd play two or three album tracks of things that we knew weren't going to be singles.
Yeah.
But the albums were out, and they sounded great, and we played them.
Now, did you have, of course, you had an hour's worth of spots that you were supposed to run in that hour. Did you have the secretary come in and stack them for you? Did you braille them to log, or what'd you do?
I had the secretary or whoever I relieved would read me the log sheet, and I worked very hard to keep Braille labels on the carts,
mm-hmm.
Because one of the first things I learned in radio is nobody puts anything back where they got it from.
No, they don't.
I never labeled records. I have seen some people who did, but I never did that.
But your ear was good enough; you could tell who it was.
Well, you know, using the cue speakers,
yeah.
But, you know, who it was. Sometimes it took me a minute or two to find what I was looking for, but and other people, as they came through, they would go pull things if I asked them to, whatever. But I had the log sheet in Braille. We were talking about sound sheets. I took sound sheets, cut them apart so that I had two pieces of sound sheet with a straight edge,
uh-huh.
and would roll them into the Perkins on that straight edge, and I'd make durable cart labels that I would place on top of the cart. And for those who don't know what a cart is, that's an abbreviation for cartridge. It looked like an old 8-track tape, and it was actually the old 4-track tape. If anybody will admit to remembering a 4-track tape, that's what the radio cartridges were talking about.
That's exactly what it was, except the difference is the pressure roller was not in the cartridge.
Not in the cart.
The pressure roller was in the machine.
And so people would take a file folder label and either scribble or in fancy stations would type on this label. It would say A&P Food Store, 30 seconds or whatever.
Yeah.
I would make a Braille label that said the same thing and using Scotch tape or whatever kind of tape I could find at the moment, tape it on the top flat side of that cart.
Yeah, so that you could feel, run your hand down the cart rack.
Just slide the cart out just a little bit and feel it. And so I did my own, once I got everything labeled, nobody had to pull anything. You know, if they cut something while I was on the air, they'd come in and hand it to me, and they'd say, you need to run this at 3:45 or whatever.
And you'd stick it over and remember.
And I would hang on to it and make a note.
And
you'd
bring
a rider
at
my feet, and I'd make a note.
Did you make them put the A&P food store commercial on the same cart every week?
I tried to do that. When we could, we did that. And by then, I was doing a lot of the production. So, you know,
yeah,
we did that, but certainly, you know, but not always. Sometimes you just couldn't do it because, you know, things rotated out. And
well, yeah, they'd have 10 A&Ps as opposed to having six, and you had
right.
to have the right length cart.
Yeah.
You didn't want too much drag through your time. Cart is, by the way, is a loop of tape. It starts, and then it has Q-tones that stop it, but it eventually gets back around to the first. And they're 40s and 70s and 100s and mm-hmm. 2 minutes. And so you want to put everything on as close a length of cart
as you can get, especially when you're loading that cart into one of these old carousel automation systems that, you know, is about as clunky as a Model T, but it works. So when you weren't running it live, then you had to load that carousel with all the carts. And we did have some music on carts, but it pretty much stayed in the carousel.
This was for your FM.
This was for the one of the FM stations, yes.
I'm sure you worked somewhere where they just had two carts, and the first one had to be through by the time you started the third one.
That's right. The experience I missed out on in radio, and I think I'm glad, is the MagnaCorder experience of having all your commercials on little, you know, 2-inch reels of tape and having to thread one up while the other one's playing. I missed that experience, and I'm not really disappointed.
I'm sure I've told this story before, but one of the funniest things I ever heard in my life, we were in the valley and the guy was kicking along. It was Christmas, and he was playing, and he said, it's 3:45, back in just a minute. And the tape said, Buttercrust, cut one. Of course, nobody else. I almost died. I thought it was the funniest thing ever.
Oh, yeah.
Because you know what he'd done. He just queued it up to, you know.
And I loved it when the network guys, we were an ABC affiliate in Vicksburg.
Yeah.
I loved it when one of the network guys screwed up. Made a blunder like that on the newscast or whatever.
Yeah.
I said, as long as you guys do that, I still have a job.
Yeah. And so you were, but you didn't have Dymo tape. Then you were cutting Evitone sound sheets and making labels.
Yes. That's rolling them into the Perkins, and I got that idea actually out of one of the first Dialogue magazines I ever read. You know, what to do with these sound sheets that by then some magazines were coming out, and you could keep them. And I used that labeling pattern for carts at the radio station. I used it on boxes of reel-to-reel tape. I used it on things that went in my freezer at my apartment.
Of course, we didn't have Dymo tape then. We didn't have label-making tape then.
Right.
All right, Mike, we're about out of time. Let's talk just a second about your radio reading service. I think you said you have 11 different transmitters, 11 different...
Eight different transmitters that serve the entire state of Mississippi, all programmed out of this office in Jackson. And it's 24-hour-a-day operation. It's fully automated with a system, system called Pristine that runs with JAWS. And I can download files into it from the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
It'll handle MP3s, MP2s, whatever you want to throw at it, pretty much.
Now, are you taking Minnesota or New York, or you do all your programming?
I take Minnesota. I take some things from New York, some things from Minnesota, some things from Kansas. And I do about 40 hours a week of my own programming here.
And do you read the newspaper in the morning, the local? I guess that wouldn't do any good because you're in eight different towns, right?
Well, we do. Well, we have a statewide newspaper, which is based here. So we read that in the morning, and I do some regional papers in the afternoon that I download off the Internet. I used to get them in here on bus, but now we download parts of several newspapers off the Internet and put together a news hour.
And you let the synthetic voice read those?
No, volunteers.
Oh, you have volunteers come in?
We have volunteers. I coordinate about 130 volunteers.
keep all their names straight and know when they're coming in and have...
And who's relieving who and, you know, so forth.
If you're just happy when your secretary comes to work.
Yes, yes, yes. Now, a lot of the things the volunteers read are recorded ahead of time.
Uh-huh.
So we don't have...
On what?
On some directly into the computer and some still on cassette, which we have three cassette decks that the automation machine will switch in and out because we have a few volunteers
aren't
happy with computer.
The quality on this radio reading service is not going to be that good. You're not going to know the difference. You know,
right. It's about like a good AM radio.
Yeah.
And since we're not dealing with music, you know, the cassettes work fine. We had for a long time, we were totally cassette. That's all we did.
Well, and they're cheap and plentiful,
right?
Believe it or not,
yeah, they are. The machines aren't as plentiful as they used to be, but you can still get the tapes.
Oh, there's plenty of tapes. I'm fixing to throw a box of about 1,000. Just, I don't know what else to do with them.
Like coat hangers. You have none or 50.
I'm fixing to dump this box. I've put it in the storeroom. I've moved it twice. I'm fixing to throw it away. I don't know anybody. I don't know anybody wants it. I'm just going to chunk it. It's probably 1,000. You know, magazines from the 1990s.
Yeah. Right.
All right. We've used up every bit of time. We got to talking radio, which is obviously maybe not my favorite subject, but boy, it's in the top three. I'll tell you that. I was just like you. I was a radio nut. I lived it, ate it, slept it, breathed it until it did me so bad. I was radio been very, very hard on Phil. I'll tell you that.
I think we all have those stories, too.
But that's another story. Mike Duke from Jackson, Mississippi. Thank you, sir. A very enjoyable conversation, and I'm going to come see you, and we're going to sit up and talk radio all night one of these days.
We'll do it. Come on over.
Well, I think we... I knew we were going to get into that, because I knew he had done some commercial radio, so I knew kind of how that was going to go. But what seemingly a well-adjusted, confident fella, Mike Duke. Never met him, but I hope to someday. Maybe we'll go to a convention or something someday. Well, we are going to do a couple more Blind Like Me's. I think in a couple of weeks they're going to do the 100th show, and I believe the plan is to interview me. We're going to do, of course, most of you, I've told you almost most of my stories, so I don't know how good it'll be. But we're going to try to do a little... interview show, the 100th Blind Like Me show. If you'd like to be a guest, please write me, email me, please, phil@philpar.net, and we'll put you on Blind Like Me. We're going to take the month of December off, but we'll start right back in January, right where we were, doing Blind Like Me shows. We will have done 101 or so by then, and we'd like to have you as a guest. If you think you'd enjoy it, email me, phil@philpar.net. Thank you much for listening. We'll see you next week. More Blind Like Me. Bye-bye.